Shalom Saints, welcome to another episode of After Hours. I'm back in the Upper Room studio, flying solo once again. Feels a bit strange not to have any company with me, but I'm here to dive back into unknown territories with regards to current affairs, new events, from a biblical perspective. And it's been a while. It's been a while since I've had to trawl through the newsreel, as it were. But I'm super happy to be back. If you haven't checked out the previous episodes with Joe and Becca, some really good stuff in there as we're leading up to the fall feasts, to the autumnal celebrations. Today's episode. Now, there are certain things that they say that you shouldn't talk about in the public domain, in the workplace, or in the pub, if you're that way inclined. And today's subject is political. Now, even the word politics can just disengage somebody's attention right away, which I can understand for different reasons, whether it's tiring of the political processes, the reporting, the saturation of this area of public domain. Or there are those who are just completely disengaged with the world and the system they're in. And so I appreciate when people aren't so enamored by this subject. However, given the current climate in terms of the political processes, both sides of the pond, I thought it'd be pertinent to take a look, because I think it's clear to see that this is an area by which a religious sentiment, at least, is attached to this. And it has also become apparent there are still believers out there who are enamored, engrossed, and perhaps led by particular tropes within the media and reports and the general algorithmic push towards a Christian sentiment towards these themes. And today, this may sound controversial, but politics is dead. As far as I'm concerned, any sense of a democratic process of a leadership that is by the people, for the people, for the greater good, for good and bad, for better and worse, I believe has ceased to exist. And today it's my goal, if you like, to walk you through why I have this conclusion, and that to be pulled to and fro by these notions is folly from a biblical perspective. Strong words, I know. But this is a conclusion that has been long in coming. And I just want to finally dot the I's and cross the T's when it comes to a narrative that I believe is so flawed by this point. And as interesting and as engaging as it is for many different reasons, we're going to walk through why I believe that this process, if you didn't think was dead and buried already, is long gone. This ship has set sail, my friends. So join me as we go for a little wander, as it were. And if, you know, you're used to that TikTok short format of bullet point, 20-second revelatory experience of media, then change the channel, because I think it's about time you put the kettle on, settle in, and walk with me as we go through this. So this may require a bit of concentration, a bit of thinking. And I don't mean that from a demeaning point of view, because I've got the attention span of something that really doesn't like to concentrate for long periods of time. So I appreciate that, but bear with me as we go through this subject, and let's get into it. So it's been a while since I've navigated this technology, so bear with me as we go through, but I've got some great articles, I've got some great videos here to go through, and to illustrate why I believe the politics is officially dead. So, just want to start with this this real short video. I think it basically outlines what we're going to be looking at today. And before we go into it, I just want you to think about the essence of policy making and legislation and the power that governments on a worldwide scale have. So this should set the tone.
Bonds are driven very heavily by government policy. Real estate driven very heavily by government policy because government policy controls capital and cost of debt, and that drives real estate. And of course, there's money over here. The government is changing this this field. Technology is changing this field. And you can work as hard as you want, but you're going to have to take into account government policy and technology if you want to actually survive in this world. Bonds are...
Government policy and technology. So we know all about the Federal Reserve. We know about Big Pharma. We know about the corrupt system, I hear you say. I get it. But today I want to illustrate the point that we can talk a lot about the broken and conspiratorial infrastructure of this world and everything within it. What I would like to do today is actually give some substance to that call and to present some facts and information that's publicly accessible, videos that are well known. For the simple fact that it can be quite hard to, you know, point the finger and say that the system's rigged and this government official is part of this society and this guy's a Mason. Like, it can actually be very hard to pinpoint these claims. And also, if you can do that, a lot of people can just say, well, so what? You know, for those of us from a biblical perspective, may be able to see for a wider lens, but those in the world and maybe even other believers can only see in sort of compartmentalized things and say, well, so what if that's a Mason or a secret, whatever. But today I want to give some solid stuff as to why I believe that politics is secondary, maybe even tertiary or even way far down the pike to what I believe is heading towards a technocratic order, essentially. So with that being said, let's have a look at the Oxford Academic. Sounds fancy and whatnot. Why and how is the power of big tech increasing in the policy process, particularly the case of generative AI? So, you know, a lot of government policy and legislation would be passed historically through a very laborious and, you know, old school way. And what I'm advocating here is that a lot of policy, a lot of movement is subject to either companies or what we're going to get into is big tech. So again, this may not be new stuff for people, but I hope this breaks down like the legitimacy of such a claim and why we shouldn't be drawn into these debates. Now, Joe, on the previous podcast, he spoke about the notion of emulations, which is a biblical framework for a kind of a system or a situation that's been designed to separate, essentially, to cause dissensions, to cause arguments. And these emulations are, in fact, the chess moves on the big board of the world that are being moved by other people. And really, as believers, can we take an interest? Can we see the movements and judgments and graces and mercies of Yah in that? Of course, 100%. But should we be drawn into to dissensions and believing that this... this almost kind of wrestling WWE style of democracy is a legitimate source. But anyway, so Let's get into it. The growing digitalization of our society has led to a meteoric rise of large technology companies, i.e. big tech, which have amassed tremendous wealth and influence through their ownership of digital infrastructure and platforms. The recent launch of ChatGPT and the rapid popularization of generative artificial intelligence, which is Gen AI, act as a focusing event to further accelerate the concentration of power in the hands of the big tech. By using a multiple streams framework, this article investigates how big tech utilize their technological monopoly and political influence to reshape the policy landscape and establish themselves as key actors in the policy process. It explores the implications of the rise of big tech for policy theory in two ways. First, it develops the big tech-centric technology stream, highlighting the differing motivations and activities from the traditional innovation-centric technology stream. Second, it underscores the universality of big tech exerting ubiquitous influence from within and across streams to primarily serve their self-interests rather than promote innovation. Our findings emphasize the need for a more critical exploration of policy role of big tech to ensure balanced and effective policy outcomes in the age of AI. So big tech is spreading, its influence is getting stronger and moving across multiple avenues and streams. And it's basically to self-serve rather than to serve the areas in which it goes into. So, the growing digitalization of society has led to a meteoric rise of large technology companies. Through their ownership of large digital platforms, big tech have amassed tremendous resources, enabling to redefine communication, commerce, and even culture. Big tech's influence is further accelerated by potentially transformative breakthroughs in generative artificial intelligence and its impact on people and organizations worldwide. So we go further into this principle. So we refer to big tech as a group of companies that own or control important digital platforms. We know the big guns: Google, Amazon, Apple, Meta, Microsoft. While the domains and models for these companies' platforms are different, they are all characterized by their intermediating nature, providing matching services to providers and users of services on their platform. So these guys are all contributing, even though it seems on the outset that they're competitors, they're basically all different facets of this same technological advancement. Let's have a... So we've got the big hitters, as it were. Let's have a look. Now, the rise of big tech as actors, I think that's a interesting word. The rise of big tech as actors within the instrument constituency must be understood in the context of changing social structures that have promoted technology as a solution to the broader social, economic, political, and environmental challenges. This technocratic power legitimizes big tech and their technological fixes. Ferrari argues that two central logics of modern-day technologies drive technological solutionism. A belief that technologies are democratic and support autonomy, and B, mutually reinforcing relationship between platform economy and the neoliberal economic logic. For me, from what I'm getting there is it's of a benevolent nature. It's for the good of the people. These factors have increased the value acceptability of big tech as legitimate actors and digital platforms as instruments in policy making. And the technical feasibility of digital solutions comes from the increased accessibility and affordability of digital technology. So such as the explosion in our domains of these technological advancements, they've just become socially accepted as just the norm and that they're good, essentially. Beyond this epistemic change, now epistemic is your epistemology, so that's where you gain your knowledge and understanding from. So what I'd like to touch on as we go on through this is within our epistemology, A lot of what we decide upon is based on data. A lot of our business, sports, just general culture is a data-driven situation. I mean, you can look at YouTube, you can look at social media. You know, it's all about collecting data and using that data to tap into the algorithms of popularity and financial gain and all the rest of it, which I think is a fascinating thing within itself. But anyway, beyond this epistemic change, discussion on the role of big tech in the policy stream most occur at the infrastructural and sectorial levels. Infrastructural services entail search engines, browsers, data servers, cloud computing, email, instant messages, etc. Skip that. So we've got this diagram here of the of all your big hitters. So you've got Meta, Facebook, with Instagram, Messenger, WhatsApp. You've got Telegram making noise. Also, you've got Amazon, like all the guys. And how these have grown to such a point that they are clearly dominating policies and legislation. And I think historically, there's been a grey area when it comes to legislation and businesses in politics. It's not really considered, probably not considered even legal for businesses to have a political influence, right? So you can look at stock markets, fixing the markets. All of these things go on, but they've generally been hard to prove, and those that are good at it get away with it. People profit from war, people profit from pharmaceuticals, people profit from certain public catastrophes, but it becomes hard to kind of prove. We see it trickle through in media. Some people get sued or taken to court, but it generally goes under the radar. However, with this, we can see like there's a big elephant in the room that I believe is driving that. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to see if we can leave the links to these articles, because they are long reads. However, I just wanted to use them to get the gist of it. And if you've got a bit of time, it's good to scan through. So here we have how accelerating technology can help make policies. And I think this was a pretty revealing insight into this principle of big tech, in particular, having a wider influence on policy making. Again, just bear in mind the whole principle of this is to show and advocate that politics and the characters within it are all well down the pecking order when it comes to what actually takes place in terms of legislation, law, and the way that the world is heading.
It's exciting times. Especially when it comes to generative AI. That being said, a lot of jobs will be rendered obsolete. But new jobs, new careers, new industries will sprout. It's what I'm focused on in my entrepreneurial career.
I don't know, like Will I Am from the Black Eyed Peas. He's like somehow emerged as some kind of authoritative figure within the world of technology. And it's, he's like, if Kanye West had stayed off all of the naughty things, he might be something like that. But he somehow finds himself in his position. It's not so much what he's saying. He's coming from a creative point of view. It's this guy. Where are we? Here we go.
What technology do you think is the big one for transforming the world we're living in?
This guy's
Google has
Google.
Been in this journey for a couple of decades, actually. AI is not new. In fact, it powers most of the products you know and I hope love, like Google Search and YouTube. But there's more out there. We're doing already some collaborations with government and using AI to make the world a better place. Just to give you one example, and then I'll get to Bard in a second. That's our generative AI service. We have flood forecasting tools that use very complex AI models to forecast floods. But we don't stop there. We're sending text messages to people on the ground that may be affected. And 2 years ago, for example, we sent over 100 million such text messages and really saved people's lives, right? So, and this is done driven by AI. Now, obviously, these are exciting times. And last week, as Will.i.am said, we announced Bard. And Bard is our conversational AI service. And you can think about...
I think he makes an interesting point in terms of like the actual physical impact of what these companies can do, which arguably compared to a government or a politician, they're going to be second best to what they can actually do in terms of the data and the technology that they have, as opposed to the little old politicians.
Of Bard as a tool that combines the wealth of the world information on the one hand with the creativity of large language models. But it's important to get it right. So that's why we announced that we're sending it out to trusted testers, because before we launch it out to the public, and this will happen in a few weeks, we really want to get it right in sense of quality, responsibility, and groundedness in real-world data, right? But when this comes out, this will allow numerous opportunities to engage in different ways with information and really solve complex problems. I can tell you I've been testing Bard for a long time, and it's my best buddy out there. But AI also comes with risks, and we need to acknowledge that. And here, I think it's a joint responsibility of companies, of governments to work together on those issues. You know, as our CEO Sundar Pichai said, you know, AI is too important not to be regulated, right? So we welcome this joint journey. Obviously, any kind of regulation should be risk-based, it should be proportional, it should allow innovation to happen, but at the same time, it should really kind of put together clear guardrails for the way forward. And I'm really excited about the way forward.
And he makes an interesting point there about in terms of the regulation of technology and AI in particular. And it seems to be like that's the only role that government seems to be serving within this story is how it's going to police and regulate it. But I would advocate that it's like the cat's out of the bag at this point. You know, Frankenstein's monster is running about town. Trying to police it at this point they may pay lip service to it, but really, I think it's just going to dominate irrespective.
Sujay, you are invested in so many companies. You're always looking out for the next hot thing in tech. You know, you bet your future on it. Is it AI for you as well?
Well, I've begun to think that AI, just when you interact with it, it's almost like a reaction to having to manage millennials for so long.
I am a millennial.
So am I, I guess, technically. But you can ask it a question, and it doesn't demand a promotion with one accurate response or a pay raise. So I think it's going to be revolutionary. There's lots of markets that we look at where AI is going to transform things. Of course, what Will's doing with FYI is pretty awesome. He was showing it to us last night. But you know, there are a number of other areas where just technological transformation is affecting everything we're doing. You know, one of the things that you and I were talking about on Friday was the idea that all of us have become obsessed with everything that's happening around climate and climate change and sustainability. And yet, when you think about it from a policy lens, despite so much effort around the world having gone into it, the person that's most responsible is not a politician for driving us forward here. It's actually Elon Musk.
Bingo. That's the money right there. It's not the politician that's driving it forward. It's Elon Musk. It's your Tony Stark coming in and... Yeah. So I think this just illustrates... And we're seeing this being played out in real time.
which is crazy. Now, it wasn't without help from government.
You said that on the phone, and I said no. And then I thought about it. I thought, yeah, I think you might be right. I think Elon Musk may have done more for climate change than the government.
The largest contributor to climate change is the transportation industry. And that entire industry is electrifying because of one company. And that's the truth. Now, that company wouldn't exist without massive government subsidies. But I think there's this intersection between policy and incentivizing great entrepreneurs that if you combine the two, you get magic. If you just have one, i.e. government, you're probably not going to end up with really great outcomes.
It says so much. So the two are colluding with each other in terms of the direction of where world governance is heading and is right now. And they're indelibly linked, but at the same time, you can't help but think that these, maybe not even the companies, but the technology and the information behind it is the one that's now in charge. And again, I just wanted to build a picture that when it comes to a political party, when it comes to a government official, whether it's in the UK or the US, at this point, if you're not talking about these current hot topics and resolutions with the right lingo, you're not going to get anywhere. So when it comes to these situations with climate change and with just the general anxieties in the world, the solution is going to be technological, and the progression is the answers is going to be within these areas, whether it's food, land, farming. You have to be willing to dance with this, and if you're not, I can't see how you're going to get on. So again, you're not going to be able to make government policy. You're not going to be able to lead ideas or people. You're going to be secondary to all of this stuff. And I think, you know, he said it there, that the magic is being made. And what an apt description. So yeah, I just thought that was very on point in terms of what we're illustrating. So came across this was a Berkeley, University of Berkeley website, technology in the public sector and a future of government work. There are reasons to be attentive to how technologies are rolled out, especially as the recent jump in technology funding opens up the floodgates of consultants and contractors pitching their products. Technology cannot be used. I think this is a really interesting point, actually. Technology cannot be used to paper over the lack of investment in the public sector that has characterized the past two decades. In fact, technology presents the greatest risk when it's simply layered on top of already overwhelmed workers and processes, because there is no capacity built in for evaluation and recalibration to ensure that the technology is working as intended, which I think is a really, important point in this transitional period, where we have great, amazing people with the best intentions working within different infrastructures, whether it is in governments, whether it is in systems of care, public systems. You've got good people trying to do good work in a broken environment. And a lot of, I think what they're suggesting is by just chucking technology at it isn't necessarily going to solve a broken system. But again, that's the direction we're heading. I think this part makes a very, very, very important point. Some technologies also present inherent risks, such as those intended to replace or supplement human decision-making. Research suggests that people are reluctant to make different decisions than those suggested by analytics designed to supplement human decision-making, sometimes leading to worse outcomes than those the technology was intended to remediate. Goes on to say, automated decision-making systems, the use of complex computer programming to replace or augment human decision-making. This group of technologies includes artificial intelligence, machine learning, and predictive analytics. By processing large amounts of data and using human-programmed algorithms or more complex artificial intelligence, ADM systems generate decisions and assessments. Now, for me, I mentioned there before about how we live in a data-driven world where decisions, processes are clearly dominated by data. And I don't think data is inherently evil. I think it's incredibly helpful if used in the right way. However, if it's completely driving everything, you're in danger, I believe, of losing humanity within a process or a system. So it can be quite harmless when it comes to, I don't know, say like a credit score or, an application for, a phone or something. I understand, there's going to be some form of data that's being used. However, if it then becomes a clinical decision based purely on data and what the statistics say, as opposed to what somebody's intuition or ability to see somebody's character, potential, all of those kind of like grey areas within humanity that no matter how much AI or data you throw at something, it's not going to be able to mimic or capture. And I think there could be situations where people do fall through the net, as it were, because you need somebody to use discernment, you need somebody to use intuition, whether it be particularly in care systems or people who are vulnerable. You need that human skill of being able to see and judge and make decisions that aren't necessarily black or white and aren't necessarily the right thing on paper, but there's that leeway. And I think, not that I'm hugely into sports or anything these days, but I think another way to illustrate this data-driven world that we live in is that you can see like a lot of, sports performers, let's take football or soccer as an example, where a lot of it is so data driven and performance driven that the statistics will dictate whether it's selection, predominantly selection, for example. Whereas I think there was a sense of being able to pick up on somebody's character or popularity, or they may not necessarily be the fastest, they may not necessarily be the most highest scoring, but they have a certain connection to fans or people, or I think that's being lost, and people can see that within a lot of elite sports because it's so data driven. It just becomes like an equation. There's not really as much room for surprises or excitement or even entertainment because it becomes so formulaic. And I think what I'm trying to say is that our world will become formulaic. Our world will become a sequence of numbers and will be dictated to by that. And if you look at the overarching theme of a tyrannical kind of oversight to all of this, it helps with a form of tyranny. If your score isn't at this, if you've not completed that, computer says no, basically. And I think that's what a lot of this is driving to. So while everybody gets up in arms about what candidate is waving the flag for, it's like, nah, guys, like, that's gone. It's gone. They're all answerable to where these systems are heading towards. Another one, article I came across, policy making in a digital world, how data and new technologies can help government make better policy. Again, another one of those documents that on the whole is probably not the most exciting. However, just when you look in the details of stuff, it gets quite interesting. Let's have a look. Yeah, progress in digital technology in recent decades has driven significant change in the economy, society, and the way we carry out everyday activities. But the way government makes policy has stayed much the same. Policy ideas from ministers or manifestos are still developed largely internally, usually with limited public consultation and with light touch monitoring of the impacts of policies after implementation. This model is outdated in a digital age. It fails to address many long-standing obstacles to effective policy making and is unsuitable for the more complex challenges government now faces. Better use of new tools and technologies can make policy making more effective and fit for a digital world. And, you know, arguably there are potential processes and systematic things that can either be sped up or expedited to benefit others, those who need help, those who need assistance in any way. You know, there can be a benefit, but I think in the long term, it's when it comes a bit unstuck. Let's just have a look. The imperative to make use of the opportunities technology offers policymaking has never been stronger. Issues such as Brexit, COVID, and climate change are more fast-moving, complex, and unwieldy than any government. Bearing in mind, these three elements are arguably manufactured. Just saying. Brexit, COVID, climate change are more fast-moving, complex, and unwieldy than any that government has had to contend with for decades. These problems cut across traditional policy and institutional boundaries. To manage problems of this scale effectively, government cannot continue with business as usual. It needs to better understand and make use of the possibilities offered by new technologies, and fast. This is a government document. And we've seen how this has been rolled out with regards to the last situation, the worldwide situation, where I think it was just a massive data mining expedition, personally. But there's another interesting bit in this. No, I can't find it. Doesn't matter anyway. You cannot make government legislation or policy. You cannot run or do anything now that is not with this program. AI revolutionizing politics, the future government impact.
Artificial intelligence is revolutionizing politics, and you won't believe the impact it's going to have on our future government. Hey there, tech enthusiasts. Did you know that artificial intelligence is rapidly reshaping the way governments operate? How is AI transforming the way we govern? Let's dive into the fascinating world of AI and politics. AI in politics is not just a buzzword anymore. It plays a crucial role in shaping government decisions and policies, from analyzing vast amounts of data to predicting voter behavior. AI is revolutionizing the political landscape. However, with great power comes great responsibility. The use of AI in politics raises concerns about bias, privacy invasion, and lack of transparency. As AI algorithms become more sophisticated, there is a pressing need to address these ethical issues to ensure fair and accountable governance. AI is being integrated into various aspects of politics, from political campaigns to policymaking and governance processes worldwide in political campaigns. AI is used to target specific voter demographics and tailor messaging for maximum impact in policymaking. AI helps analyze complex data sets to inform decision-making and in governance. AI aids in streamlining administrative tasks and improving public services. One striking example of AI's impact on politics is the use of AI-powered chatbots during elections to engage with voters and provide real-time information. These chatbots have significantly increased voter engagement and participation, showcasing the transformative power of AI and enhancing democracy. In conclusion, the integration of AI in politics is inevitable, but it must be done thoughtfully and ethically. It is crucial to strike a balance between leveraging AI's capabilities for efficiency and innovation while safeguarding against potential risks and biases. Understanding the implications of AI and politics is essential for ensuring a fair and transparent government. What are your thoughts on AI and politics? Share your opinions in the comments below.
So we have this sentiment of the moral centering, as it were, of the technological influence on governance, because it's undeniable at this point. You can't get away from it. However, it's being presented to as a neutral, benevolent source of a data-driven way of systematically leading people and making decisions that affects a lot of people. But you have to question about the source of AI, where it comes from. And like with a lot of these subjects, looking at it from a spiritual perspective, where we are in terms of the eschatology of biblical prophecy. Again, there's debate on where that is, depending on what camp you're in. However, you can't help but see that there are some serious movements, both in the natural world, the sociological world, and in politics. Everything is developed to a point of being so polarized, where if you vote one side, if you vote for Trump and the Republicans, you are a Nazi right-wing sympathizer. If you vote for the left, you're a communist, Bolshevik demon. And it's one or the other. And we've seen the same happen in the UK recently. If you lean towards one particular way or the other, it's become so separated. And as again, we go back to this principle of emulations and orchestrated divisions. Are we, as believers, being sucked into this narrative, or are we going to see the bigger picture and say, this is all heading towards a technocratic, spiritually dangerous, and antichrist narrative, essentially? As we head towards a technocratic process to world governance, is this getting closer to godly values and closer to God's word in terms of the functionality, or is it getting closer to the opposite of that? So that's the question I'm posing, is are you being fooled into thinking that these individuals, either on the left or right, who cherry pick certain Christian triggering topics, whether it be children before birth, whether it be gender issues, whatever the hot topics are, and whatever they appropriate in order to gain popularity or to sway public opinion, none of these guys care. They're not changing or doing anything. And I think it's about time we just draw a line in the sand and say, look, okay, on a local level, if you want to have an impact on what's going on in and around your state or in your area, then by all means. But from a worldwide level, if you cannot see this at this point, like, you really need to wake up. And people often cite the phrase, two wings of the same bird. Well, at the head of that is the technology. The progressive left will impact on the philosophical, will impact on the sociological side, the attitudes, the what's culturally appropriate. But the right-hand side, that's the money, that's the system, that's the business. And they're all coming to the same junction. So whether you're a Republican, Democrat, whether you're conservative or Labour, and I know we can get emotionally pulled because traditionally one might have one set of values more than the other, but what I'm saying is that this it's gone. It's gone. It's this. And where do we stand in this? In the context of the Antichrist and the beast system. And I know there's lots of conjecture and opinion on that. But we got to ask ourselves, what role is the Antichrist spirit having within this technological infrastructure? How is he having an influence? You know, the prince of power of the airwaves. How is he using these systems in order to influence and to cultivate his impact on the world? So one last video to look at. Now, I don't know many of you out there who rode the first wave of QAnon and how Trump was going to drain the swamp and how RFK was, really going to come in and do some serious damage to the political state. I just want to highlight this principle and whether they know it or not, how knowing they are as agents in this, I don't know. But RFK, he's just affiliated himself to Donald Trump in the latest elections. Now, this guy rose to a lot of prominence on the sort of fringe alternative media because he was standing against FACOs and medicine and Big Pharma and saying a lot of good things. And has since kind of fell back on what he's said. That's a whole different thing within itself. But this particular video, I think, illustrates, again, whether knowingly or unknowingly, how we're heading towards this technocratic state of affairs.
Independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wants the public to know how much something as trivial as a toilet seat will cost the government.
We're going to have 300 million eyeballs on our budget, and if somebody is spending $16,000 for a toilet seat, everybody's going to know about it.
Speaking at a rally in Michigan, Kennedy stated he wanted the United States budget on blockchain to make government spending transparent. A blockchain is a ledger of transactions used with cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin and Ethereum. Kennedy's reference to longstanding scandals that the government overpaid for toilet seats served to show the true transparency blockchain would offer. With the government planning to spend some $3.8 trillion this year, the independent candidate would have an extremely steep slope to climb if he ever gets to put his claim into motion. Kennedy has long championed cryptocurrency. He said he would accept campaign contribution in Bitcoin and held up to $250,000 in the cryptocurrency at one point last year. Stand With Crypto, a nonprofit group, rates Kennedy an A grade. Former President Donald Trump has a B, and President Joe Biden a D. Kennedy recently polled at 13% in a five-way poll between him, Biden, Cornel West, and Jill Stein. The poll was conducted before the rest of his family endorsed Biden.
So my point with this isn't necessarily to say that, you know, Bitcoin, blockchain's evil, da da da. The point being, Bobby Kennedy there, he was talking about how he wants to make the government transparent by putting everything financially on blockchain, which is, in essence, a digital certificate of movement and data. which could be used for businesses or individuals. And there's a lot of advocacy from these big companies and individuals with influence who are trying to move a lot of things into blockchain, into this digital world, where it be medicine, schooling, finance will all be on the blockchain. And I guess this is homework for you, as Tommy would say. Do a little research on the role of blockchain and the future Beast system and how that could be assisting this digital move into quite a unnerving future. The point being with RFK is that he rose up through the ranks, allegedly as being this man of the people, saying a lot of the right things. But here we are, 3, 4, 5 years down the line, and he's buddied up with Trump, and he's talking about the use of blockchain. Worrying times. So, once again, I hope that I've shown or illustrated a point there with regards to how I feel about the modern political landscape, without being either derogatory to individuals or mean spirited to anybody in any camp. That's not my intention. I hope that today's episode has maybe got some people thinking about where they stand in the equation. And it's a subject that we've touched on quite a lot within these episodes, in terms of the role of technology and culture, from a spiritual perspective. But I thought to emphasize the political element now, because I think we're arguably wasting our time getting drawn into arguments on this at this point. So once again, am I wrong? Is there still scope for the political realm to be resuscitated with decency, integrity, and a true democratic process? Or, as I mentioned, has that ship set sail, and are we doomed for an AI-driven political leadership as we head towards a newer world order, perhaps? I don't know. As ever, reach out in the comments, and be interested to hear your opinion. So, thank you once again for joining me. I hope this has been of a benefit to you, and I hope you're all keeping well. So, from our house to yours, this has been After Hours. Take care. God bless. See you on the next one.